Find out how you can support this podcast at patreon.com/PaulWheaton.
This is part one of a two-part podcast.
Those of us with computer hands.
It's gone.
Oh, it is?
Yeah. Well, before it didn't work.
I mean, we can stop it and start it again.
Why?
I was just talking about those of us with computer hands versus those of us who use hand tools.
Oh, right, right. Well, my hands have gotten pretty soft. The 3.5 years that we've been here, I haven't done very many projects of my own. I mean, I've done some things. There's, I've done some pretty serious earthwork stuff by myself, and I've chopped a fair bit of wood, but I think my hands are pretty soft from all the time at the computer. Before I forget, those were some excellent sunchokes the other night. Man, those were good. So Jocelyn made some amazing sunchokes, and so you had kind of not exactly fried them, but slow fried of some kind.
It's crockpot cooking.
And they came out like caramelized candies. Mm-hmm. And so we had like caramelized candy with gravy on it. And it tasted so good. I don't know, I've eaten sunchokes a couple of dozen times, and people call them fartichokes. And I've never had a problem with that until this week. And I don't know if it's a problem or if it's just more comedy in my day. But wow, that was, not only were they the most delicious sunchokes I've ever eaten, and boy, those were good. And so it's like, I want to say, oh, you got to share that recipe with everybody in the world. But I had seconds because they were so delicious. I finished them off. Oh, they're so good. But that night it started, and it went through
the night,
most of the day, the next day.
Yeah.
I
didn't get them in the crock pot early enough in the day, so I had them on high for quite some time in the crock pot. I didn't harvest them till about 10 or 11 that morning. So they didn't make it into the crock pot till almost midday. And they just were in bacon grease and seasoning salt in the crock pot on high. But, somebody else could do coconut fat or whatever. The goal was to cook them long and slow. And I didn't have all day. I only had half a day. So I'd like to try them again, longer and slower, to end up at the same result, hopefully with less side effects.
Because we have a lot of sunchokes.
We do.
We have gotten.
Yeah, it was, I had half a basket full, like a big bowl full, just from one cluster outside our bedroom window in the hugelkultur burns. And I, had lots of little tiny starts to shove back in the soil so we could still have a cluster growing there. But yeah, it was just one. I just started grabbing the stalks and pulling them out and cutting the stalks off and putting the little bits back in. And it took me probably a minute or two to harvest a big bowl full. Probably.
Okay. All right. Well, now my guess is, because I know camas is something where the traditional way to cook camas is a day and a half. So it would be an earth bake kind of a thing. And so I don't know if like setting the temperature to much lower and then going for a day and a half instead of 6 hours might solve that problem. And I know that when we were over visiting that guy in Portland, Norris Tomlinson, he made most of his diet because he was measuring every calorie that came off of their standard urban lot. And they wanted to know how many people can you feed without adding in inputs. And so they're very, very carefully measuring everything, documenting it daily. And he's a large part of his diet was sunchokes because they were just so prolific. And of course, sunchokes are famous for being the most calories per acre.
Right.
And I kind of wonder, when they say most calories per acre, do you take into account trees that are growing 100 feet tall? Because that would probably generate a lot of calories.
Right.
You know, one of my customers in New Mexico has a pecan tree that regularly puts out like 350 pounds of pecans.
Wow.
You know, and I've heard in the South there's trees that'll do 500 or 1,000 pounds of nuts every year.
From one tree.
From one tree. So if you had an acre, you know, and the pecans usually around 70% fat. But
that'd
so,
be a lot of, that's a lot of health, calories.
A lot of healthy calories.
Yeah.
Getting back to the sunchokes, they have inulin, which is meant to be a prebiotic, which feeds your probiotics in your gut. And that's part of why they're not as digestible and they don't spike your blood sugar as much. And there's all these good, good things about them being high in, I believe it's called inulin. Mm-hmm. There's a thread at Permies that I was just posting to in the fermentation forum called How About Sunchokes? And someone in there mentioned that later in winter they have less inulin and they might be more digestible. And then someone said, is that really what you meant? Is that true? And nobody's replied yet. So it would be lovely to further that part of the discussion in the fermentation thread, How About Sunchokes? And Joseph Lofthouse just posted his favorite way to ferment sunchokes. And I've got some sunchokes fermenting right now, too, with some turnips. And hopefully those will be more digestible.
So inulin is the same thing as fructooligosaccharides.
There we go.
Which are not, I mean, it's like Purina bacteria chow.
Yeah.
And the reason why they advocate it is because if you've got a highly fungal system, fungus apparently can't eat inulin. It's like, I don't know what to do with this. This is like not a food. Huh. But the bacteria is like, yum, 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 yum. And then we can't digest it very well. Okay. My understanding is that we can digest a little bit. Mm-hmm. And when you say, when we go into this whole discussion of like digestibility or not digestible, then you end up in this place of like, apparently that equates to, in this particular variety of not so digestible, that works out to farts a lot.
Right, right.
A condition known as farts a lot.
Right.
So, but when you cook it for this incredibly long time, then apparently it converts the inulin into FOS, fructooligosaccharides, inulin, however you want to call it. So thus gives it that candy-like flavor, which it was. It was like eating savory candy.
I'm glad you liked it.
Which I like. And it was kind of caramel.
Do it again.
It was kind of chewy. It was like sticking to your teeth kind of chewy. Like, nyang, nyang, nyang. So it was delicious. Oh, it was so good. I could have eaten more, much more. But I think if I did, I would have ended up in pain. Unfortunately, I wasn't in pain. There was just bonus comedy for me.
And me. No. Maybe I should harvest some before dinner and get them started tonight for tomorrow night's dinner. That might be a worthy experiment.
Oh, are we doing, is feast night on?
No.
Tomorrow night's dinner.
Yours, my dinner.
Oh, okay. For just our dinner.
Yeah.
Just food for us.
Yeah.
It seems like you're usually like planning all week for feast night.
Yeah.
And it's like, then I'm going to cook this, and then I'm going to cook this other thing. And then, of course, Thanksgiving's coming up. So, you know, I can't help but think that you're going to be cooking all day, every day for the next 6 days for Thanksgiving.
No, I'm usually not that organized, to be honest.
What were you making last night?
Well, last night I started fermenting cranberries. days for Thanksgiving next week. Josh brought
I rest my case!
Cranberries. Anyway, and some of them have the apples that Kai and Fred foraged nearby, and so we have a cranberry apple relish fermenting and honeyed cranberries fermenting with honey from the lab for Thanksgiving. So.
And what were you doing just a moment ago?
Planting tree seeds, tree seeds.
So all you were planting were just pits and seeds from whatever food we were eating the last couple of days.
Yeah, well, they're older than that, but...
Okay, all right.
So who knows if they're that viable, but it got me out walking and...
You kind of... Don't you have like a little container around here somewhere where you kind of save all the... And she points right at it. It's right there. Duh.
It's a basket full of many containers.
Okay. And then, so then every once in a while you take one of those out and you plant a lot of whatever's in that little jar. Okay.
Yeah.
Just thought I'd share that because we haven't made very many podcasts lately, and now you're pushing for podcasts, and so there's probably hundreds and hundreds of things to share that we got to share only as we remember them of things we're doing. So I know that around here, like last year, Kai went and planted a bunch of apricot pits, and there's a few apricot trees out there, and Kai also planted a bunch of apple seeds, which I think it was apple seeds from that night where we were out at Jacqueline Freeman's place, and they had that big apple tasting event, and we saved thousands of seeds and carefully labeled them and brought them back. And then, and apple seeds apparently only remain viable for a year. And these were now like 6 or 7 years old, and they were finally getting planted.
Yeah.
So,
we have lots of baby apple trees about.
Yes.
Which is awesome.
Yeah.
And Jacqueline asked me about that. You know, did any of those sprout? Because we spent hours. We spent hours. Because it was a tasting. You could taste over 300 varieties of apples. Pink fleshed apples, baking apples, heritage apples. It was amazing. And they saved all of the apple cores for us from over 300 varieties of apples. And you and I sat there and with little pocket knives and took all the pits out and put them in little coin envelopes. And I remember, you know, the knife only works so long, and then you're digging it out with your thumbnails, and then everything gets jammed up under your thumbnails so that your nail beds hurt after a while.
They kind of sting. The apple juice gets up in there and kind of stings.
Yeah, because you damaged your stuff from picking too much. Anyway, that was
hours. So we paid that price.
Hours.
Saved all those seeds, and they finally got, and there's some little baby apple trees around. Some are doing better than others. I mean... Basically, like the hugelkultur bed out here is dirt on top of wood, and we really need to make that into soil. And I think this year, so the last couple of years, it's been like, you just leave it. We're not going to irrigate anything because I want to be able to say, and we never irrigated. So this upcoming year, I think any irrigating with a watering can is going to be fine. And I think that there's going to be some stuff that we're going to try and start. Because we've got to build the soil up to get it to the point that it can do that. And some of this stuff is like sand. It's like just a big gob of sand. And we're just now starting to get some stuff to grow in it enough that it's going to start building soil.
They're so tall and steep, it's been difficult to keep mulch up on the upper regions. They're regions, you know, because they're so huge.
Especially with the turkeys knocking it down. And
yes. Yeah. And Fred moved a bunch of logs up near the base camp hugelkultur berms, and hopefully we'll create, you know.
Scaffolding.
Yeah, scaffolding, so we can better work on all regions. And so that's something, you know, maybe the Boots and Roots will be working on at some point. So Boots to Roots.
Boots, people. Yeah, the Boots. They'll someday be Roots.
Yes.
Yeah. So, all right. I've got a list of a few things to go over, and then you've got a list of questions that people asked 3 years ago.
2 years ago.
Is it 2 years ago?
Yeah. Well, getting close to 3 years, I guess.
Yeah, almost nearly 3 years ago.
Nearly 3 years, because it was January
And
2014.
And so it's when you broke your arm.
Yep.
And they had asked a bunch of questions, and then you broke your arm, and then anyway, so there's some questions left from that time. And then on and one of our podcasts a little while ago, Fred mentioned Patreon and how we should get the Patreon thing going. So then a bunch of people went out and put money into it, and now we have like $201 per artifact.
Boom, baby.
Yeah. Yeah. Way to go, Fred.
Thank you, Patreon.
Way to go,
supporters.
Patreon.
So I posted something out there that only the patrons at Patreon can see that is like, you know, here's a list of things, and two of the people at Patreon suggested that we do a podcast about going from being a FERD to being a GERT. And so I think that's a really good idea. And so maybe that'll be one we'll do in the near future.
Yeah.
And there were a few other things that they suggested. And today I was out fiddling around because now everything's different. And so I was out fiddling around with my YouTube channel and discovering the new features that have been added to YouTube and the Patreon page to kind of like get those two kind of merged together. But so far, because for each thing that people can, when they put money into the Patreon account, they can select what they like best, articles or podcasts or videos. And right now, articles have a strong lead. I think podcasts are next and videos are last. Mm-hmm. So maybe I need to, you know, spend Thursdays writing articles instead of making podcasts.
It could be because the people that know about your Patreon found out about it from the podcast. And none of your YouTube viewers know about the Patreon, so they're not contributing to that aspect of your Patreon.
Ooh, good
oh,
point.
Man. Yeah.
Good
yeah,
point.
Gotta give them a fair chance, I guess. All right, so that's a thing. That's a thing that exists now, is this Patreon stuff. And $200 per artifact, that seems pretty good. And it used to be there was a time when I could do every other day was a podcast and every other day was a video. And so I don't think I'm going to be able to hold that pace now. But there is a thing at Patreon where you can say, I'll put in $1 per artifact with a maximum of $1 per month. And so because I couldn't – some people set up a Patreon account so that they get however much money it is per month. And even if they don't put anything out. And I kind of felt like I couldn't do that. And so I put it up to be per artifact. So then I like the idea that if now it's not an obligation. So if I received some amount of money in a month and then I didn't do anything, that would be bad. That would be an obligation is poison kind of thing for me. And I emailed Patreon yesterday and said, is there any chance that you could make it so it's like 10 cents per artifact? And I never received a response. I suspect I never will. So a person could do $1 per artifact with a maximum of $1 per month. And that would get you into that little area inside this deal where you can specify, like, what do you want? What are things that are of interest to you? All right.
And if it's $3 or more, you can get your name on the podcast summaries or on the article or on the video, as in, thank you for being a Patreon supporter.
Right, right, yep. And so that'll be on the video, it'll be in the description. For the podcast, it'll be at the permies.com page. Mm-hmm. And for the article, I guess it'll be at the bottom of the article.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, all right. Now, so there you go. There. Let's see. That's the Patreon note.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to go finish my list here real quick, and then we can go on to your questions. Is this all right?
Yeah,
okay.
Of course.
Jesse Grimes put out an excellent video today. It's all about the Ant Village. He went and he visited. Let's see, I think there's five. It's he showed his own project. Not very much of his own project. They don't see the inside of it really, but he showed Evans, Steve's, Jim's, Janet's, and then Josh and Ben's bear den.
And Kai's. Yeah.
Oh, and he showed Kai's. That's right. Yeah. And so Kai's got a little cob structure up there,
mm-hmm.
Which we hadn't talked about before, because before we were talking about ants, and Kai is been given like a little, it's called Kylorado on Ava, which is Evan's plot.
Yes.
Yeah. And so Evan's got a plot, and so this little slice of it is for Kai. And then Kai and Evan are like doing oodles of stuff on that plot.
Yes.
So, and then somebody asked also, they were asking like, they're saying, oh, somebody's coming out like December 2nd to be a boot. They're going to be our first boot for the boot camp program. And they're saying, maybe I should build some bunks. And so then I kind of did the math and I said, well, here's the bunks that we have now, and so for every bed that is a full size or bigger, and so you can assume you could put a couple on there, then we have enough bunks for 23 people, and that's with nobody sleeping on the floor. And those are almost all currently empty. And really the problem that we had is that people would occupy a bunk and they wouldn't do anything, and our projects would sit idle. And that's not entirely true either. We had people who would occupy a bunk and do a lot, and we had people who would occupy a bunk and do diddly, and then that would develop resentments.
Right.
And it, in the end, it worked out to be not very effective.
Yeah.
So now with the whole boot camp program, I think that this solves that. And that, you know, if a person's occupying a bunk as part of the boot camp program, then I think it'll all work out. Because before, I think I when I replied to this guy, I said basically a person would do about 4 hours per week of work, but then they would cause more than 4 hours worth of stuff that would then need to be repaired by somebody else or cleaned up or whatever. It would cause more projects than they would resolve.
Yeah, we had to change the Gapper program because it just wasn't a productive model the way it was happening. It didn't produce the artifacts or the outcome of projects that you wanted. It didn't produce the community and the long-term people we had hoped for. It didn't produce kind of even a temporary community, resilient community as we had hoped. It like you said, the resentments happened, all of those things. So we had not been giving bunks to the Gappers because we didn't really have a program where it made sense in terms of all types of productivity. And I'm using that word very loosely. So it didn't make sense to give them a bunk in the redone Gapper 2.0 program. But for Boots to Roots, it's a structured program. The goal is learning, and learning while building artifacts and forwarding projects here that you want forwarded. So it's worth it to us to provide a bunk, which costs us. I mean, it costs us in terms of cleaning up after people. It costs us in terms of wear and tear. It costs us in terms of community effort and making sure everything is smooth. You know, it's kind of an expensive thing. And again, I'm using that loosely, to provide someone a bunk. But if the return is your projects are moving forward, and the return is for the Boots to Roots person that they're learning and they're working towards a Deep Roots package, then it should be, and I wish I had a better word than productive, it should be, you know, really good for everybody involved.
Yeah. I remember that one of the biggest expenses we had big expense with tool burn, we had big expense with food. And we had an enormous expense with cleaning up after people.
Yeah. Well, and we paid a full-time cook and pretty much full-time cook and people to clean up.
It was a full-time cook.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's still, and it was still very, very stressful for you and I because it wasn't all happening as we had hoped. It just, it wasn't working out.
So I think that with strong leadership, it'll dramatically reduce tool burn. It will, we've got a plan for like not having a cook and the boots cook for themselves, but, and then the food budget will be probably a quarter of what it was before. And then I think that part of it is going to be that the, there'll be strong leadership, which will ensure that the boots effectively clean up after themselves. So, you know, and that the time the boots spend cleaning up after themselves is not the same time, because that started to happen towards the end of the 20-month party, is a lot of the boots were like, oh, I'm going to clean up after myself during the 35 hours a week I'm supposed to be putting in. And so then, you know, and along the way, while I'm cleaning up after myself, I'm going to cause another mess, and then I'll go clean that up. And then even after all of that, we still had to spend months cleaning up after the 20-month party. It might even be fair to say more than a year. But all right, all right. So the key is, this is all related to Jesse put up a good video. And it's a tour of six structures, seven if you count Jesse's. And yeah. And it's like that's up on Permies right now. And R. Ranson said she's going to send out a thing in the Daily-ish today about it. So if you're on the Daily-ish, you probably saw it.
And Jesse also is on Patreon and has good support there. And yeah. And Evan and Kai are on Patreon as well. So their stuff is a monthly thing, that as opposed to a per artifact thing.
Right. Evan hasn't been putting his pictures up as much as he used to.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate. He used to be pretty diligent about putting up three per day.
Yeah.
And lately there's not been so many. All right. So next item on the list is that we went to see, so Thomas Elpel came to Missoula. This is the author of Botany in a Day. Mm-hmm. And I've got that, I think it's a 9-podcast review of Botany in a Day, which people can get from Scubly. And I struggle with botany. I really, really struggle. And I thought that by reading Botany in a Day that suddenly I'd have this magic ability to, understand botany, understand the scientific names, things of that nature. And, it didn't really stick in my head. And so Thomas has been here at Wheaton Labs a couple of times, and I exchange emails with him fairly regularly, and so then he's coming to Missoula, so it's like, you know, and I know you very much are interested in botany, and so we went to his workshop. It was a two and a half day workshop
at Green Path Herb School, which is run by Elaine Chef and John, I don't know how to say his last name. Goy something bitch. Something.
Yeah.
Anyway, but they run a great herb school. They used to own Meadow Sweet Herbs, and they moved into doing the Green Path Herb School full-time, and they have great events there. And it was a great weekend. It started off with a Friday night that was free and filled up. They had a waiting list for that, and then Saturday and Sunday was the paid workshop all day that Paul and I went to.
Now, when Burra was here, so she came over here for like a month last year, and then Thomas stopped by, and he dropped off a bunch of books, and one of them was Sean Lyas' Quest. Mm-hmm. And Burra read it, and she reviewed it on Permies, 10 out of 10 acorns. She talked about it the rest of her time here, about how excellent it was. And it's a kid's book. It's quick. Yeah. It's got lots of pictures. It's lots of art. And not an incredibly huge amount of wordy bits. And I had not opened it. And, you know, it's here. And we've got, and also Thomas dropped off a deck of cards that goes with Sean Laya's quest. And I didn't look at those either. I mean, we just, I don't know. I've got the same excuse everybody else in the world has. Oh, who has the time? And so one of the things that we did is that while I drove to the workshop, then you took out Sean Laya's quest and you read it aloud to me.
Yeah, and only let you look at the pictures briefly because you were driving.
Right. And it was really good. I mean, it got a lot of that stuff to really stick in my head. And it's like they talk about the Mint family. And so Sean Laya is on this quest and she goes to this island. That's the Mint Island. And she says, pretty much everything is edible. You can eat whatever you want. It's all very friendly. And then you go to the parsnip family, and it was kind of evil.
You mean the parsley?
The parsley family. You're right. I'm already forgetting it. Look, it's already starting to come unglued from my head. And it's like, you got to be careful because there's a lot of stuff in there that's poisonous.
Yeah.
And then, in fact, while on the island, the main
person
there, the guardian, tried to poison her. And so I think, you know, this is a good lesson because, of course, carrots are from the parsley family and they look a lot like some of the other things which are poisonous.
Yeah.
And so it's like you got to be really careful. And then it also talked about how to identify. And then, of course, throughout the class, when we're actually sitting down with Tom, then it's kind of like all these things are the identifiers. It's kind of like these identifiers are used to tell you what it probably is. And of course, the thing is with botany is such a massive, massive field. And on top of that, and he said that there's a total of like 300 families, and Sean Laya's quest covers probably the eight most popular. And within each family, there's usually 3,000 to 15,000 species in a family. And then on Friday night, I think we spent most of the night with his decks of cards, and we played card games, but it was kind of like, in order to make the next move, is you're kind of holding your card thinking, boy, I really need a mint. Or, you know, I sure hope I get something from the pea family because then I'll be able to, like, go out. Or, you know, or it's one of those slap games where it's like you can only slap if there's already a pea on there. Do I have any peas? Slap that card down there or whatever. Then that's...
Yeah.
So there's all these games that are really kind of forcing you to really learn. And then he had like another deck of cards that he didn't make, but had the same families in it, but it was different photos.
Yeah. And from a different country, so you couldn't always cheat by reading the names either.
Yeah.
That went with the photos. But
which the names are supposed to be exactly the same. If you do the scientific names... Which was another thing is Tom doesn't really, you know, he's not big on the scientific names. He's far more interested in the common names.
Well, I think he, you know, I think the Sean Laya's quest and the Sean Laya's card game, even though they only deal with the eight families. I mean, when we brought that back, we were so excited to show it to like Fred and Kai. They were like, you know, yawning like just now. But that's so boring. Those families are the easiest. But for someone that's trying to build confidence in how to identify plants, it's brilliant for adults or kids. You know, it just starts you somewhere with identifying plants. And I think what Tom did really well in the class is he didn't go too far. I mean, he just went far enough to kind of give you a taste of all the different ways you dissect flowers and seeds to identify the plant family and figure out how they reproduce and stuff. And I think that's where he truly geeks out, and he wanted to go there, but he held himself back knowing it would be too much. Because then I was talking about, we learned about the chambers or I forgot
the pistils and the stamens.
Well, it's beyond that, down to where, you know, the seed chambers, and they're called gosh, I forgot now. And then Kai was like, oh, you mean la da 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 da, and I was like, oh, he didn't use that word with us. He used a dumbed down word for us, so we wouldn't overwhelm. Because when you use new vocabulary, it's like talking a new language, and people's eyes glaze over, and they just can't take it in. If you know, if you're using a language like you talking software engineering to someone who's not into software, me talking accounting terms to someone who's not into accounting, you know, people just kind of, ugh. And when you get into those botanical terms for way beyond pistils and stamens and petals and things like that, it's hard. And he held himself back, but I think that's where he really geeks out. And when we went out identifying, he had all these pocket magnifying glasses and little knives and stuff, and we were pulling apart these flowers and looking at these microscopic pistils and stamens and ovaries. And
so it all starts off with, like,
yeah,
here is the sexual organ for this plant.
Yeah.
And now we're going to tear it apart.
And see what, yeah. Well, yeah, it's however many parts and whether they're joined or not. And this is how you identify the plant families. So when you use whatever guide you have, whether it's Tom's book or whatever, you walk through, okay, does it have opposite leaves? Does it have whorled leaves? Does it have...
And then in the end,
these things,
you'll be able to say that it's probably something.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's like, you know, when you start keying it out, you got to get lots of practice and get better and better and better at it. Mm-hmm. And the problem, well, I guess one of the problems that I've always had is that I don't go out and do the disciplinarian thing of like, and today I'm going to try and identify three more plants or something like that and key them all out. And it's, no, it's more like after a while I get used to identifying certain plants. And so there's a bunch of plants here that I can identify fairly easily. But it's kind of like, it's a bit hit and miss. It's a bit, I mean, I think, and then of course, I thought was interesting is what Tom said that he did when he first started getting interested himself, is that if he found something he couldn't identify, then he would take it into the extension office and have them identify it. And then, of course, he was really close to Bozeman at the time when he was a kid, so he could take it to the university. So rather than the extension of the university, it would be the university.
Mm-hmm.
And then there, you know, have a actual, you know, official botanist kind of, you know, describe what he found and what it is and what's the story with it.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing that he did on the walks is anytime he found a plant that he knew was poisonous, he would take a bite out of the poisonous part.
Yes.
And yeah, he'd fucking eat it.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, and you tell, it's like, wow, that is very astringent. It's drying my mouth out. It's like I have no moisture in my mouth now from just that tiny little bit. It just sucked all the moisture out of my head. I probably look more like a raisin now that I have eaten this. And yeah, he says, and it's supposed to cause heart attacks or something. You know, you'd start listing off, and this is how you die from this. And it's like, but, and of course, the thing he's, you know, he's trying to say is that it's like, if you eat just a tiny little bit, the odds of you really doing something horrible to yourself are pretty slim. But at the same time, he did point out that there were some things, even a tiny bit is way too much.
Right.
So,
like poison hemlock.
Right. Whereas he was showing us he was eating nightshade.
Yeah.
You know, and it's kind of like, yeah, this is famous for being poisonous. And here I am, I'm going to eat a little bit.
What else did he eat? Snowberries? Those aren't like poisonous, but I mean, he ate quite a few different things that you're, ooh. And I think what he was trying to demonstrate is most of those, they just don't taste good.
Yeah. But he was also exploring what kind of poison is it?
Yeah.
And so what are the kinds of poison and what do they taste like? And so then you can kind of identify poisons in a plant. And so that was an interesting little thing. And then, of course, I thought, you know, always good in a wild edible walk is it's like, and here's something that's edible. Not palatable, but edible. You could eat this, you just don't want to.
Right, right. We ate mountain ash fruits. We ate...
Oregon grape.
Oregon grape, rose hips, knick.
Is Oregon grape... I mean, when you eat the fruit, which looks like a grape from Oregon grape, every time I've ever put it in my mouth, which is more than a dozen times, it tastes terrible. Every time. Now,
I understand that
it looks ripe, and then it sits there for 3 or 4 weeks. Actually, it probably sits there for 22 and a half days and tastes terrible. And then for 20 minutes, it probably tastes good. And then it rots in about the next 40 minutes.
I tried one today, and it didn't taste terrible, but I wouldn't describe it as good either. but yeah, it had lost a lot of its astringency.
Okay, so it was probably on the rot scale.
Closer, yeah. I mean, but there's been several freezes.
Right. So. I'm surprised there's any left. It seems like the critters get them and clean them out pretty fast. Hmm.
I see them on there late. Right. I don't see them cleaned out by critters.
It seems like 95% of the time I see Oregon grape, it doesn't have any grapes.
Oh. Hmm.
So, but lately, this year, seems like a year where I've seen Oregon grape with a lot of grapes. All right. So, and then my last note about Thomas Elpel is that we took him out to dinner one night, and... We had a weird incident. It's like, oh, there's a new restaurant in Missoula. It's got organic stuff and things. And so we went there only to find out. So it's like, they just opened. And, I don't think I'll ever go back. Not only are there no tables inside at all, there's like, they've got some benches around the perimeter.
With counters.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Counter. There you go.
Counters to sit at.
Yeah, but you can't sit like across from a person. You can only sit facing a window. Mm-hmm. That's your only option. But they did have some tables outside, so we went outside, and I had forgotten that the Pavarello Center had moved to being in that neighborhood. And the Pavarello Center in Missoula is the place where it's kind of like a homeless shelter.
And they have a lot of veteran services there, too.
And I think their policy is that at 8 a.m. every morning, it's everybody has to get the fuck out. And they're not allowed back in until like 5 o'clock or something like that. And so then there's this parade of guys coming down the street, and we're sitting outside to eat. And so one guy.
He was crazy.
Yeah. It was not good. Mm-hmm. And he brought us not good for 7 minutes. We asked him to leave several times, but that just made it worse. So, not going back there.
But, yeah, that was too bad. But it was nice to visit with Tom a little bit outside of the class. He's gearing up to rewrite one of his books this winter. That's what he likes to do in the winter. And during the non-winter season, he's outdoors as much as possible, it seems like. And busy guy.
All right. The last thing I have on my list is that we've got a pond up at the lab, and we have discovered that even though there is a lot of clay in this spot, that the pond leaks. And so I think that the best thing that we could possibly do is to put some pigs in there for a while, especially through the summer. And then the pigs will probably seal it up pretty damn good. But right now, no one up at the lab has pigs. So as people are thinking about being an ant or being a gapper or boots or whatever it is, if they want to come and raise pigs, that would be good. And we could use that. There, that's my list. Jocelyn, what's on your list?
Well, these are some items from 2 years ago from the Sunday Walk podcast thread. And the first question We didn't quite get to these. We only had like two real Sunday Walk podcasts from almost 3 years ago. And we meant to get to these, and we just kept talking about other things and didn't quite get to these. Permies user named Kitty wanted to ask about annuals. You know, how do annuals work in a permaculture system? You know, she drives past monoculture fields of berries and corn and wheat, but you know, how do you get past a monoculture with all the annuals we need, especially in a northern climate, in a permaculture system?
All right. She says, I'm looking at the thing that you put in front of me here.
Yeah.
I know some plants self-seed, but that's not a sure thing, right? How would people get all their food from permaculture? There are not enough perennials in the northern climates to provide everything people eat. I drive past monoculture fields of berries and corn and wheat, but how would enough of this food be produced for all the people in a permaculture-based society? So first of all, I would have to say that, you could eat strictly perennial foods. Why is it that she's saying you can't? I don't understand that. So there are not enough perennials in the northern climates.
I think maybe what she's asking this is because a large part of the standard American diet is annuals.
So she wishes to continue, like where's the pizza plant? Like, well, where's the hot dog plant?
Even, you know, Carol Deppe has that book, The Resilient... The Resilient Gardener? Yeah, I have not read it, but... From what I hear, she recommends growing corn, which is an annual, and squash, which is an annual, instead of growing grain crops, other grain crops like wheat or oats or rye or barley. She just thinks, you know, especially in northwest areas, it's easier to grow corn and squash as your main starches. And those are still annuals. So I think that's what she's talking about. Plus, a lot of people are used to spinach, lettuces, tomatoes, you know, all of these other food crops that are grown as annuals in northern climates for their main food, main vegetables.
All right. I get it. It's what people are used to for their gardens.
Yeah.
And so I want to start off by saying, I'm glad to talk about it. We're going to get into that.
Yeah.
I just want to be really clear that a person could eat just perennials,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so it seems to suggest that you can't, and I want to say you can. And so, all right, so we got that covered. And I think that permaculture systems are going to be a mix of annuals and perennials. Now, here we're in a northern climate, and I would say probably one of the most dominant species is annual or possibly perennial. And it's going to be along the lines of what most people are concerned about. So you mentioned corn and grain.
Yeah.
And corn's definitely an annual here. And grain is usually an annual.
Mm-hmm.
But, there are perennial versions, and perennials are becoming more and more prevalent in permaculture circles for grains. And so we have tons of grain growing here. And we generally don't harvest it or eat it, but... Grass. All grass is grain. So it's there. It might not be a variety that you're used to or a variety that you like, but it is there and it is growing. Now, I think it's an excellent point that some plants self-seed, but it's not a sure thing. That is an excellent, excellent point. And I think there's a lot to be said for when you get your permaculture system going and all you have to do is harvest, then the more you nurture it, the more you're going to get back out of it. So with just, I believe we've said in the past, like with 16 hours of work per year, and it depends on a lot of different things, you can quadruple the amount of food that comes out of your plot. It's the more you nurture, the more you get. Now, some of it's going to be planting seeds and some of it's going to be mulching, and some of it's going to be possibly pruning, some of it's going to be chop and drop, selecting what you want to give preference to. But I think it's going to be a system that's going to be dominantly perennial, but with some annuals mixed in there. Did I answer the question?
I think so. I know with our greens, my favorite greens here are lamb's quarters, which we were just talking about, common names versus botanical names. Chenopodium albus. Is it albus?
Alban. Alba.
Chenopodium alba, which we call lamb's quarters in these areas. Other people call it pigweed in different areas. That is a self-sowing weed, an annual, I believe. So, and that's one of my favorite greens. It's just pops up everywhere. Dandelion is a perennial green, and we have some lovely varieties that are quite mild growing around base camp that I think we might have brought seeds in for the, some of those, because they have nice broad leaves and they're less bitter. So those are two of my favorite greens. We have a lot of kale here, but we planted a lot of kale. And I think, we saved a lot of those seeds and replanted. Anyway, those are, I don't know. I just want to talk about some of the greens here because I harvest a lot of those. Orach is an annual we planted here that I'm hoping we'll self-sow more, and plus I took a bunch of the seeds and spread those around a lot. I'm hoping we'll get more orach.
Also, I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with annuals as part of your system, as long as you're not doing monoculture or you're doing it in the same spot every year. Like, why shouldn't you be able to grow squash or potatoes or whatever, as long as you're paying attention to how it's doing in the spot you're planted it.
Well, so rather than trying to change your spot, I think that the thing to do is just do polyculture in the same spot year after year. Mm-hmm. And that if you've had something growing in the same spot, because the reason for it is, that they've got it, rotational crops is what they would do. It's like, okay, I'm going to plant peas in this. I'm going to do a monocrop of peas here this year, but I'm not going to do it next year. I'll grow wheat here instead. Because when I grew peas there, then it built up all of these things that like to kill peas, all the pea diseases. Mm-hmm. And then so it's all built up. So now this field is rich in pea diseases. And so what I'm going to do is next year I'm going to grow not peas. And so then those pea diseases will die out. And after about 3 years, I'll bring peas back again, because then it's safe. Those pea diseases have been reduced down to practically nothing. And now I can grow peas here again. So rather than doing that, I think the thing to do is to do a polyculture. And if it's possible, you grew peas in the exact same spot for 4 years in a row, and those pea diseases built up, not a problem. And you've got a polyculture. You've got a bunch of stuff there. So if the pea diseases really did build up and it's going to kill your peas, something else will grow there. Something will do better there than peas, and then you won't really have peas there. Mm-hmm. So nature will sort that out for you. You don't have to think about it.
And with the polyculture, you'll have lots of things that like to eat those pea diseases.
Ideally, yes.
Delicious pea diseases. Yeah.
Well, I think what makes sense in a permaculture system are some conversations I've had with Sean at Feast Night. So Sean has been buying a lot of squash for the seeds, to save the seeds and plant them on his Ant Village plot. And I think we used spaghetti squash and made and put pesto on spaghetti squash, noodles, which aren't really noodles. But we talked, and one of my favorite pizza crusts or starchy bready type things, because I'm gluten free, is just to slice a lovely squash or sliced potatoes or sweet potatoes, or if we can digest the sunchokes, And I use those as a bread base, like for pizza or for something else. Somebody else might use it as focaccia or something. You know, I use a squash or a tuber of some kind, and then that's my starch. And we talked about that's far easier to grow than growing a grain, because the processing of the grain, you have to go through a lot to try and make a bread product out of it. If you're growing small scale grain and then you have to thresh it and then grind it and then turn it into a bread product, if you can just bake spaghetti squash, fluff it with a fork, and you've got noodles, I mean, that's a lot easier than making noodles out of grain you grew and threshed and ground yourself.
I think this is a really good time to point out, and I think a lot of people who might be listening to this, this is going to, the things you just said sounded terrible.
Sorry.
And what I want to do is I want to repair that.
Yeah, good.
and it's kind of like, I think that, and it kind of comes back to that problem where a person will grow a magnificent garden and then, you know, 90% of the food rots because nobody would cook it. And so that I mentioned this in the podcast at least once, where there was that guy and he made a, he grew an enormous garden.
Right.
Nobody in all of his family, they turned their nose up at it in favor of going and eating at Pizza Hut, McDonald's,
right.
Domino's, etc. And so it's kind of like, I think a lot of people are like, you know, rather than spaghetti squash, because now I've eaten a lot of spaghetti squash that tasted like exactly like squash.
Which isn't like, your favorite flavor.
Which is, it, and it's like they wouldn't even put any butter or salt on it. It's like, no, it's good like this. You shouldn't eat butter and you shouldn't eat salt. And it's terrible. And it's like, now Fred's over here probably thinking, oh, squash is good. It's, you know, yummy. I'm just going to eat it all up. And so I kind of feel like in the hands of an excellent cook, then I think that a lot of the things that are made with squash are far better than the stuff that we eat more conventionally. So, you know, the wheat-based stuff or, you know, because you're right. It's like making something that's going to be like pizza with squash is going to be faster, easier, and far more delicious than it's like, okay, pick off all the fucking grains, separate out all the fucking chaff, and then you've got like hardly anything. Do that 200 more times, then grind the fucking shit, and then find out that that wasn't ground fine enough, so grind it again, set it for super, super fine, and really work up a sweat grinding it. Now you've got flour. Now you're going to mix it with water, maybe a little oil, a little salt, a little yeast, and you're going to make it rise. You know, so this is going to be your pizza crust. But it's kind of like, it turns out to be, and the reason why it's so cheap, of course, is because it's so heavily mechanized at this point in time.
And subsidized.
And subsidized.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, but it comes down to having, and this is where I think all these paths lead to permaculture, homesteading, and I should change my phrasing, permaculture, homesteading, and community.
Yeah.
And it's like, so you can have somebody that's bonkers about gardening, and then, you know, such as myself, and but like a total dipshit at cooking, such as myself. And so it's like, then there could be somebody else in the house who is bonkers about cooking, and in which case it all works out, and then you have something amazingly delicious all the time. And so what it sounds like, because I think a lot of people have never tasted really good cooking before, and it's like even if they go to a nice restaurant, a nice restaurant's going to say, okay, you can have steak and mashed potatoes. You are allowed to put butter and salt on your mashed potatoes, and there'll be some green beans which will be buttered. And that's like considered a really good meal, as opposed to the kinds of really good meals that we have here all the time, every day. which are going to be more like the squash. Like, oh, here's spaghetti squash. It was so easy to make. And then there's like a homemade spaghetti sauce to go on the spaghetti squash or whatever. There's so many different things that are made well.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. And I think there are different types of gardeners. Some would love to see how good they could be at growing grain, and others would love to see how good they are at squash. Others, they want to grow the perfect tomato or peppers. I think Sean's excited about growing peppers. So, you know, and that's where it is lovely to have community, and you don't have to do everything all yourself, and you can trade. You know, someone who's really into peppers could trade for someone who's really into grain or whatever.
I'd like somebody to come out here and be amazing at raw milk. Yeah, I used to drink a lot of milk. I'd like to get back to that. But all right,
Kai and I harvested a bunch of wheat. Like, we filled up the back of his truck with wheat because there was this, that place I was telling you where there was just wild wheat growing.
Wow.
And cool. I think he spent a lot of time threshing that. He built this thing with like a chain on the end of a all thread and put it in a bucket. And
I have a video showing how to do that.
I think he ended up with about 10 pounds of, of wheat berries.
10 pounds of wheat berries. Good for him.
I think it was, yeah, it was a couple gallons. And
what was in the back of his truck? Was it like was it the straw or?
Oh yeah, yeah. Because we didn't do the thing you were talking about where we were just pulling the heads off, but we went with the side and cut down. And it was not the modern wheat that's only, you know, like a foot and a half tall or whatever. This is the older wheat that's like 5 feet tall or something. So it was long, you know, big pieces of straw, which he ended up using to build his house. So worked out for that, for his cobbing. But yeah, it was a lot of work to get that little bit of wheat.
Yeah. Yeah, but what a find, and what a fun experiment, if it was a lot of work.
Well, and I think, you know, most of what, when we found it, most of it was already laying down. And so if we use the harvester that Paul was talking about, which is basically like a scoop with slits in it to pull just the heads off, we could probably increase our harvest rate quite a bit. And
we'd leave behind that lovely straw.
We would leave behind the straw. Yeah. But maybe you could do both, where you're just getting the heads. Because while we were scything and carrying these bundles of wheat on straw, we were planting a lot of it, in, you know.
Yeah.
Which is good and bad, but...
right.
Right.
This podcast is continued in part 2.